Navy League Sea Air Space, held in person August 2nd through 4th at Gaylord National Harbor, is the largest maritime expo in North America. Register to attend at seaairspace.org.
Welcome to What Are You Reading? A podcast dedicated to leadership development through commitment to reading.
Welcome back to DoD Reads. This is your host, Bridget Calhoun. Today, we are privileged to host the Honorable Deborah Lee James. From December 2013 to January 2017, Ms. James served as the 23rd Secretary of the United States Air Force with responsibility for 660,000 military and civilian personnel and a budget of nearly $140 billion. She was the second woman to ever lead a military service in the United States. Prior to this role, she served as the president of Science Applications International Corporation's technical and engineering sector, a $2 billion, 8,700-person enterprise. Earlier in her career, Ms. James held other profit and loss positions and worked in the legislative branch of government and the Department of Defense. Ms. James has deep experience in strategic planning, risk management, public policy, cybersecurity, space, logistics, and innovation. She is an accomplished speaker on business and government topics, including issues in national security and world affairs, politics in Washington, business transformation leadership, mergers and acquisitions, cost reduction strategies, and diversity and inclusion. Ms. James is the author of the book, Aim High, Chart Your Course and Find Success. She earned a Bachelor's of Arts in Comparative Area Studies from Duke University and a Master's degree in International Affairs from the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. Ma'am, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bridget. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're very grateful that you're here with us today, ma'am. And the first question we always ask our guests is, what are you currently reading?
Well, if you will permit me, I want to tell you actually about two books, one that I'm currently reading and one that I just finished, which I think is fantastic too. So the one I just finished is called Uncharted. It's by Margaret Heffernan, who is a PhD business leader psychologist. And the point of Uncharted, the thesis of Uncharted, is in this day and age in which we look at data and shred data and information every which way in order to try to predict the future. Nonetheless, the future is inherently unpredictable. And so absolutely, we should continue to rely on data, look at data and so on, but let's not take it to the bank because we need to also be prepared at all times to pivot, to test out new concepts, to do scenario planning, which of course our military is top notch at. But no matter how much we try to predict, most of the time we predict these things wrong or partially wrong. So I really recommend Uncharted by Margaret Heffernan. The one I'm into right now is called The CEO Test by Adam Bryant and Kevin Scherer. And this is it's a quick read. It's kind of a conversational storytelling book. And it talks about what these two gentlemen, by the way, the authors, one is a New York Times columnist who sort of made his career out of interviewing CEOs and kind of what makes the best CEOs tick and other types of leaders. Matter of fact, when I was Secretary of the Air Force, he interviewed me. So it's all kinds of leaders that he interviewed over the years. And Kevin Scherer, who at this point is the retired CEO of a company called Amgen. But anyway, they have this really interesting book. It's about the qualities and they have case studies about the best business leaders out there today. So CEO Test by Adam Bryant and Kevin Scherer.
Those both sound like great reads, ma'am, especially the former one, Uncharted. Just sounds like a very refreshing perspective on data. Because we're hearing a lot, both in military circles and also in the private sector, that data seems to be everything. But there's, of course, a human component to it and a lot of other factors that play into how we make decisions. So having the information available is great, but there's a lot of other things that we have to consider going into these problem sets that we have in front of us. So that seems like a very informative book on that topic of just broadening our decision making.
Absolutely. And I also want to say that myself included, many of us have read a lot of military leadership books, and those are fantastic. But I would really recommend to your listeners as well that they expand, if they haven't already expanded their horizons, and read some business-oriented books. Number one, you'd be surprised that the qualities of good leaders are frequently very, very similar. And it doesn't matter I mean, there are some specifics, right, for military leadership and some specifics for leading in a profit and loss organization, but there's an awful lot of similarities, way more than you would necessarily expect. And let's face it, whether you're in the military for 4 years, 8 years, 20 years, or 30 years, eventually you are likely to touch the business world, either directly when you leave the military or while you're in the military, because partnership between the commercial world and the military world is crucial for all of our technology, for all of our acquisition programs.
Yes, ma'am. And I think your career is a perfect example of that. And you wrote extensively about that in your book, Aim High. And one of the things I loved most about how you structured the book is that you devoted a lot of time to the topic of mentorship. And in chapter 4, which is titled Get a Mentor, Be a Mentor, Build Your Network, you share stories about three gentlemen whose mentorship made all the difference in your first government job after graduating from Columbia. So could you tell us a little bit about these mentors and if they had any books specifically that they recommended that had an impact on you at that point in your career?
The first mentor that you're referencing, Bridget, was a man named Major General Bob Berquist, Major General of the Army. And indeed, my very first job out of school was with the Department of the Army. And without going into too many details, if the listeners perhaps think that I always aspired to be involved with military affairs or military matters, the answer is absolutely not. My first dream was to be a diplomat, but my first dream, went bust. It went up in smoke. So I suffered a sort of what felt at the time like a devastating setback. Of course, with perspective and years and so on, it wasn't nearly as devastating. But it was one of those pivots that I talked about when I talked about Uncharted that I made. And instead, I went into the Department of the Army. My very first boss was fantastic, this Major General. And what was fantastic about him? Well, he gave me frequent feedback and advice, not just the once a year type, which was very normal, 30 years ago. That sort of frequent feedback is much more what good bosses and leaders do nowadays. And he did it for me long ago. So that was the first thing. But he went beyond that feedback and advice. He also took an interest in me, where I wanted to go with my career, other opportunities that I might want to have. And then one step beyond that as well, he opened some doors for me and helped me make it happen by introducing me to some people and opportunities that I could have never made those connections at such a young age by myself. So he was really instrumental, and I will be forever grateful to him. And he has passed away. So I've not had the opportunity to tell him that lately, but I did tell him that in mid-career. The second one was a guy, another Army leader. His name at the time, he was Major Bob Kimmett, and he was at the National Security Council staff. By the way, Major Bob Kimmett eventually went on to become, many years later, the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury and the Ambassador to Germany. And he's had a very, very distinguished career both in and out of government. But he started, of course, as many do, in our military. Now, how did I meet Major Bob Kimmett back in the day? Well, literally, I was in the audience and Major Kimmett was giving a speech. He was giving a presentation about the role of the National Security Council and some of the hot topics of the day. And I thought to myself, wow, that sounds like an interesting place to work. So literally, I took a deep breath. And after the presentation, I walked up to him and waited my turn to shake hands and say a few words. As I recall it, I was the last one in line. And I ended my commentary with, I am a presidential management intern, and I can rotate to other organizations while still being paid by the Department of the Army. Have you ever had a presidential management intern at the National Security Council? And would you consider me? Would you be willing to have a cup of coffee? And we could talk about this, and I'd love to hear more about your career. Well, it took a while because this is a busy guy, but he finally fit me in. We had that coffee. And within a few months after that, I did rotate to the National Security Council, and I spent 6 months on his staff. And that was just an unbelievable experience. So this is why I tell people sometimes it's necessary to go on the offense and get your own mentor. I didn't ask him to be a mentor, but he in effect became an informal mentor to me and has remained so throughout our lives. And then the last one is Kim Winkup. So Kim Winkup at the time was the staff director of the House Armed Services Committee. And he was one of the connections that Major General Berquist made for me. So after I concluded my NSC rotation and I went back to the Army, I then had another opportunity to rotate to the House Armed Services Committee. And that's where Berquist introduced me to Kim Winkup. And from there, I ended up joining the House Armed Services Committee, which became a 10-year stint. And Kim Winkup really was my, you know, next great boss in life. All the same things I described in Berquist, the feedback, the advice, making connections, giving me new opportunities. And I remain very close and in touch with Kim to this day. Now, about the books, Truth in Advertising, I don't recall them recommending books. And I also recall in myself kind of a fatigue from reading so many books in college and grad school, because I did go directly into both. So to the extent I remember reading in those days, it was more about current events, trying to come up to speed, mostly the news articles, the periodicals, magazine articles, anything I could absorb about military, but mostly it was current events. And then further Truth in Advertising. By the time I got on the House Armed Services Committee, I'd had my first child, and I was too exhausted to read or do anything else in those days, except maybe the little engine that could and the little baby books that we had. So my, you know, reading on leadership and so on and more pleasure reading came to me a bit later in life.
Yes, ma'am. Although it is kind of fun to go back and reread some of those childhood stories, and they strike you in a different way as an adult. I'm finding that with my nephews now as we read the Winnie the Pooh books, and there's a lot of good nuggets in there for adults too.
Absolutely.
But I love the story you shared about getting onto the National Security Council, and that's something that I've found as a younger officer and now transitioning to more of the mid-career field grade level and giving advice to other subordinates is that you have to be aggressive in seeking mentorship. Yes, it's built in to our leadership structure and everyone should be mentored, but you also own a little bit of that responsibility yourself. So being bold, as you said, and just kind of putting yourself out there, and the best leaders will hardly ever turn somebody away. I think, you know, it may take time, as you said, to get into their schedules, but if they see some potential and hunger in you, then they're going to want to help you out. And I think that's just a great testament to having that hunger, but also recognizing that your mentor doesn't necessarily need to be a carbon copy of you. As you shared too, ma'am, I've had some of the best mentors in my career have also been men or other women that have multiple children, or they came from a different background or something like that. So I think that's just another good refreshing point about mentorship is you don't necessarily need to pick someone who has an identical life path or career path to you. There's great things that we can learn from everybody and really shouldn't try to close any doors on mentorship either.
Totally agree. And mentors are all around us. They could be your neighbor. They could be someone that you go to church with. They could be any number of people. We just have to open our eyes and be willing to ask for that cup of coffee sometimes.
Yes, ma'am. And you've definitely carried all of those lessons forward to being a mentor yourself, both at SAKE and then when you became Secretary of the Air Force and starting the lean-in circles at the Pentagon. Drawing from those experiences, what advice would you give to military leaders for developing their own mentorship and leadership development programs within their units?
Well, I think if you're the leader of a unit in one of the military services, and again, I think this is advice that I would give to leaders in business as well. It's providing that frequent feedback and that encouragement, just as you heard I received from the three mentors that I talked about earlier. So get to know your people as real people. Make sure that you're communicating effectively and clearly and provide that frequent feedback and encouragement. I would put that as number one. Number two, I would say, get yourself educated, if you're not already educated, about what programs may already exist in the larger organization. So for example, a unit leader in the Air Force should be aware that there is an Air Force program called MyVector. It's a headquarters leadership program. I had the honor of actually launching it, and I always refer to it as the match.com of mentoring, insofar as people who want mentorship will go online, they'll register, they'll talk about their backgrounds, and they'll talk about the type of mentoring that they're looking for. And likewise, people who are willing to mentor, myself included, I was a mentor through this program when I was Secretary of the Air Force, we too would go online and put down our backgrounds and talk about the type of mentorship that we could offer. And then through the power of computing, we were able to make these matches. And sometimes we could do the mentorship one-on-one personally if they were in the same geographic area. And sometimes we would be talking with people virtually who were stationed elsewhere. But it's that type of thing. Understand what programs may be available and make sure that your people are aware of it as well and applying for such programs if they are eligible. And then I would also just simply say, do it and encourage your subordinate leaders to just do it. If we can borrow that phrase from Nike, take the action, do it yourself informally. Again, it comes back to that frequent feedback, looking for those hungry people who want more, and then trying to link them up with the opportunities and other connections that can, or learning approaches that can help them down the way.
Absolutely, ma'am. And I think the use of a program like MyVector really helps address the younger generations that have come into the services that are used to doing a lot of things online, whether it's networking for professional reasons or even dating. It's kind of a forum and construct that they're used to. So I think speaking in the language, you know, of your target audience is very important, and the digital platforms that we use for that certainly help with the communications on that front too. I hadn't known that program existed, but that's really fascinating.
We'll have to get it going in the Army.
Yes, yes. We'll see if we can do something about that. And ma'am, you also dedicated a chapter in Aim High to ethics. And as the Secretary of the Air Force, you managed several ethical conflicts, including a cheating scandal within the nuclear enterprise and ongoing sexual assault and harassment within the Air Force. And unfortunately, those are two problems that the military still struggles with. And most recently, we've seen in the news cheating scandals at both West Point and the Naval Academy last year, and then the Sharp crisis at Fort Hood, Texas, that still seems to be unraveling. So can you tell us about your ethical formation? Obviously, the mentorship that you had and your higher education played a role in this, but are there any particular ethical thinkers or school of thought that you've studied who have shaped how you look at ethics and just your character overall?
I think ethics is really quite much more easy to comprehend than most people give it. We talk about the complexities of the ethics laws and this, that, and the other. I think it boils down to ethics is all about doing what you say you're going to do, doing what you know to be right, because we've all been raised with certain ethical values, and do it even when it's hard and even when no one is looking, especially when it's hard and especially when it's tempting to do it otherwise, and especially when no one is looking, because that's when sometimes we think we can get away with things. So I can't think of a school of thought of ethics particularly that influenced me. I think I've learned more about ethics by doing and watching what others do, and also watching what others have done wrong and how they stumble and fall. And of course, I've seen this in both government and I've seen this in the private sector. As I think back, it's not like an ethical thought piece perhaps, but one of my favorite books from my SAIC days that I'll tell you about, and it had a very, very strong ethical foundation to it, was a book by a man named Harry Kramer. Harry Kramer was on the board of SAIC at the time, and his book is called From Values to Action. So it's a very ethics principle-based book. And again, Harry Kramer is a business leader. He was translating, this is his philosophy of how there are four principles that, you know, every good leader ought to have and ought to practice. And those four principles are, first of all, self-reflection, the importance of taking time to think through what are your personal values? What is your true north? And do the goals that you have put forth for the organization, do they align with those values? And do they reflect that true north? So that's self-reflection, really what matters, he says. The second is balance. That means take time to understand all sides of an issue, all sides of a story. You need that in order to reflect balance. Number three is to have true self-confidence. And he says that true self-confidence means that you have to have the self-awareness to know what you're really good at and those things that you're not so good at. And then the key is to surround yourself with other people, not fear those people, but embrace those people who are stronger in those areas where you are weaker. That is what he calls true self-confidence. That's what I call play to your strengths within a great team. Because by the way, that's in my book as well. I very deeply believe in that. And then the fourth is humility, which again requires self-awareness. You need to know yourself and you need to be able to admit what you know, but what you also don't know, because none of us knows it all. So that's another book I would recommend, From Values to Action by Harry Kramer. So again, I think for me, it's been somewhat about the reading perhaps, but it's much more about the case studies. And I do include some of those in the book as well. Things that I saw go wrong in industry and some things that I witnessed in government as well.
Absolutely, ma'am. And I think for a lot of us, it does come from the values we were raised with. And then you get out into the real world and you live through your own case studies, so to speak, with these different experiences. And I think books like the one you just referenced are helpful when we're trying to figure out with where we are in life and matching our values to the reality. Sometimes just going back to a trusted thinker like that who can lay out a framework, as you said, with the four steps, the four components, is very helpful. And I think in the military, we prioritize kind of higher level ethics thinking really to when you become a more senior officer or a senior NCO. We give a little bit of introductory at the commissioning sources, but we do have each service's values, like the Army values, of course, are very widely promulgated and everyone seems to understand those. But I think with a lot of these crises, we tend to focus on managing crisis once it has happened. And there's still debates of how do we really prioritize prevention, specifically for sexual assault, sexual harassment, and suicide, and things like that. And I think just knowing that there are more of these kind of ethics and values-based books out there that either could become part of a mentorship program, professional development program or something, or just service members who want to pick them up and read them on their own can definitely be a helpful stepping stone in forming our own character and just understanding how to handle some of these crises that have become very public and the military is still trying to figure out how to handle them as well.
Right. Agree. Very much agree. And of course, in the Air Force, I just read, of course, there's a new concept of operations paper that the chief of staff has put out. This, of course, happens every so many years. But I noticed that the basic tenets of Air Force ethical behavior have remained constant. So there have been some things that have changed in this new approach, but some things remain the same. So our ethical foundation in the Air Force remains integrity, service before self, excellence in all we do. So to put that in plainer language is do the right thing, even when nobody is looking, especially when it's hard. A service before self is all about humility. This is about a greater good. This is about the country. This is about the organization and doing what's right. This is not about me as an individual. And excellence in all we do is all about don't cut corners, give it your best. Remember, there's this higher purpose and we all must pull together and do our best.
Absolutely. And in the era that we live in now with disinformation and just the quick ability for narratives to be construed, that sometimes our adversaries or people that just don't wish us well can get in front of those much sooner than we can. So you're absolutely right, ma'am. Living with integrity and just owning up to something if we do make a mistake before somebody else can craft a counter narrative and get in front of us. We've seen this with some of the cheating scandals and stuff like that that have happened. And of course, our adversaries would love just to see any other things that can divide and weaken our military happen. So I think this is a point that perhaps could be emphasized a little bit more is, yes, we need to handle the crises once they happen, but the values and ethical education as well, I think we really need to extend across the entire force, you know, perhaps in some different ways too, as part of a mitigation strategy.
Agree.
So, ma'am, transitioning to current national security affairs, we're hearing a lot more about public-private partnerships these days, especially with Operation Warp Speed and how we're handling the COVID crisis as being the ideal model for American victory and great power competition. As someone who has worked in both the public and private sectors, what opportunities do you assess will be the most promising for such partnerships in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, Bridget, as you alluded to, literally everything that we do in government depends on some form of a public-private partnership because so much of the actual work is done by industry. And the military or another part of the government may oversee it. Of course, they do a lot of work as well, but the point is it's more oversight, it's more technical direction, and the actual production, the actual work of the day takes place in industry. And this has always been the truth. So it's always sort of a no-brainer that we have to have a tight connection between the government and the private sector. But the truth is, I've been around long enough to see it ebbs and flows. And over the decades, sometimes it's very standoffish between particularly the military, the DOD, and industry. And then sometimes we do have a closer partnership. And it usually depends on whether or not there have been procurement scandals of late, things of this nature. Because when there are such scandals, and there's always going to be somebody who's going to try to cheat the system, when that happens, both the DOD through regulation and the Congress through law comes down pretty hard, because everyone says, never again will we let this happen. And so there are road humps put up, not blockades, but humps along the way to slow everybody down. And what we have now is a system that is too slow as a result. All these regulations and laws were put in for a good reason at the time, but of course we never go back and review, or don't go back and review enough, and then we don't strip away any of these things. So anyway, the answer to your question is there are lots of opportunities in the next 3 to 5 years. And I would say that the most important partnerships will be in the areas of cyber, space, artificial intelligence, machine learning, hypersonics. That's a big one for the Air Force. It is for the other services as well. Quantum science and computing, which has the potential to allow us to speed up lots and lots of processes. And then I'm sure all of your listeners and you as well, everyone has heard about Joint All Domain Command and Control, which is still developing, but this is an effort to link the disparate command and control systems of all the military services and allow us to bring information to bear much more quickly, so that we can decide across services and across domains how to put firepower on a target, you know, which weaponry to use, or maybe it's a cyber weapon, and be able to do it much, much quicker. That will make us a much more effective force and really leapfrog us ahead as we think about this great power competition era that we now live in.
Yes, ma'am. And that's encouraging to hear that you see opportunities across all of those different areas. Of course, you know, they're very technologically heavy, but I think that's definitely the sector that the government needs to lean into. And we've seen some great success partnering SpaceX with NASA, you know, most recently with the launch that just happened a few days ago. And I think that's encouraging to other people, both in the public and private sector, that there are success examples that we're living through right now that we can expand these off of. And of course, looking at our adversaries that have more centralized economies, more tightly controlled forms of government, the lines between public and private are certainly more blurred. So they're able to, I guess, just naturally by the form of their government, have these types of partnerships already built in. But it's something democracies, of course, have to work a little bit more hardly on. But I think everybody has generally come to a consensus that this is the direction our country needs to head for defense and national security. And I think a lot of people on both sides are excited about a lot of these opportunities too. So it'll be great to see where we move as a nation, you know, both people that are in industry now, but even high school and college students that know these are opportunities that they can matriculate into once they've graduated. It's a very exciting time just watching this national effort seem to unfold right now.
And the areas that I mentioned in particular, certainly the big defense primes that everyone, you know, knows the name of, Lockheed and United Technologies, Raytheon, and I'm talking about the big ones. They're involved with some of this work. But the other exciting thing is small startups and the innovation coming out of hubs like Silicon Valley and Austin and Boston. There's also really great commercial technologies out there. And the military in recent years has really leaned forward to try to have approaches that would attract these smaller firms to the government, to make it simpler to understand our requirements, to make the RFP and bidding process more simple, faster, et cetera, so that we do get the benefit of some of these emerging technological breakthroughs that are coming from the small companies.
Definitely. And I think within the next 3 to 5 years, as we talked about, we'll see a lot more of these coming up. And it would be fun to do a repeat episode, you know, down the line and kind of do a playback on where some of these have gone. And I know this is an area you're heavily involved with now, ma'am, since completing your assignment as the Secretary of the Air Force. You've completed and taken on an expansive portfolio of consulting and mentoring across numerous subject areas. So what are some of the projects or engagements that you have most enjoyed from this chapter of your career?
Well, to be honest, I enjoy all of the buckets of activities, Bridget, that I'm involved with. I like to tell people I'm a gig worker now, because I don't have a singular full-time job, but I've got a bunch of part-time jobs. As you mentioned, I sit on various boards of directors for both for-profit and nonprofit charitable organizations, and I do some consulting as well, which allows me to sort of keep fresh in my expertise, to keep on learning what are the topics of both interest to the military today, to business today. So it allows me to give, but it also allows me to get. So I keep building my knowledge that way too. One of the most enjoyable is, you know, tell you the truth, is the mentoring that I do, which I now do at a professional level. So I've been mentoring a long, long time sort of informally, but now I do it formally to C-suite level executives, to some of the Fortune 500 companies. And the reason why I think that's so enjoyable is, you know, just working with a single person. And if your advice can help them break through and become a better leader, and if it's a single person, they will typically tell you, they'll tell you on the spot or next week that they tried out your suggestion and it really worked. So it's a great sense of fulfillment, perhaps a greater sense of fulfillment than I might get from consulting. Because when you consult with a company, half the time you don't know whether they take your advice or not. This way, I kind of get that direct feedback. And then the other thing that I've really enjoyed is speaking. So I speak now pretty extensively on national security topics. And of course, I have been speaking since I published the book Aim High a lot more on leadership. And that's been great fun too. I will tell you, I never realized that I have a newfound appreciation for authors and what authors go through. It is really, really hard to write a book. So I can't imagine I would ever write another book. And I will tell you, it was not fun writing it. It was hard. It was a grind. But now that it's done, I feel kind of proud of it. You know, I had one book in me and I got it done. And I've really enjoyed doing podcasts, doing interviews, doing speeches, just like we're doing today. Because some of what we talk about, it allows me to give advice and mentor at a much broader level. It allows me to do it from everyone who reads the book. So that's been a great deal of fun too.
Yes, ma'am. And I remember listening to another book talk you gave about Aim High, where you said a lot of those ideas were already in your head and it was just a matter of getting them down on paper. And when I listened to that, I thought, oh, she must have had an easy time writing this book. But hearing you now echoes a lot of what other people have said, that writing is just a painful process. It's not really enjoyable, but once you get it done, you really reap the fruits of it. Did you have a pretty aggressive timeline for getting the book done, ma'am? Or was it just some other conditions that you felt made it that much harder to try to get the book completed?
Well, first of all, I didn't start it until after I stepped down from the government. So at that point, I had much more time on my hands and I was able to devote time. But here's the deal. Once you get a book contract, there are deadlines in it. Now, of course, I intellectually knew there'd be deadlines and there'd be contractual things that I'd have to do. But once you've got it and the deadline is looming, wow, it's a sense of pressure. And then I would sit down, I would try to create a schedule for myself. So I would try to say, okay, this week I'm going to write for 3 days, and 2 days I had to do, let's say, something else. Well, you sit down on the day you're set aside to write and you have writer's block and you can't get it down on a page, or you keep rewriting it and it becomes just very, very frustrating. And that deadline is looming in your head. So there were many times that I was into it and was just like, why did I get myself into this? You know, nobody forced me into this. I actually wanted to do this. And I was sort of regretting this at times. But like all other things, if you can simplify it, I am a big believer in lists. I think lots of people love lists the way I do. So I finally boiled it down to 3 essential actions. And there's like 10 strategies that fall under these actions. And I have a 5-step repeatable process to get things done. So I have lists within lists, but it really helped me to organize the book. And then I had stories from my own life. There's facts and figures in the book too, don't get me wrong. But I think people identify more with stories. I know I do. And I know I remember stories better. So I had stories that went with each of these principles and strategies. And then I was very fortunate that Bain & Company, which is a premier consulting firm, helped me with some of the data and some of the research that does appear in the book. By the way, that's another thing that really lengthens the period of time that authors need to write books, is when they're doing their own research. Again, Bain helped me with that enormously.
No, that's great to hear, ma'am. And I really appreciated the structure of the book too, because you can look at the table of contents and know exactly what the book is about. And even if you want to go back and refer to it, it's very easy to tell exactly where in the book to go to get those nuggets that also have a story that demonstrates the example that you're trying to make. But then the summaries at the end of the chapter too, which I know that's where Bain put a lot of their good statistics and research into as well. It's just very easy, whether you want to sit and read it cover to cover or just kind of go back and look at certain instances. From the reader's perspective, even though it sounds like there are certainly some challenges with getting it written, I really do appreciate the way that it's structured. And it's been easy just to go back and reference as I've needed to since I first read it a couple years ago.
And with my military training, you'll recall, I started with the bluff, the bottom line up front, and then my final chapter was the bluff revisited, where I kind of summarized it all. So I used my military training in the book as well.
Well, that's probably why I enjoyed reading it so much, ma'am. It was familiar language. So thus far in the podcast, ma'am, we've talked almost exclusively about your professional career, but I'd also like to highlight that you are a wife, a mother, and now a grandmother. And at the time that Aim High was published, your granddaughter, Liana, had just been born. So could you tell us a little bit about life as a grandmother and how that's been treating you so far? And then just any other advice you might have for women who are trying to juggle both family responsibilities with those of their careers?
Well, I mean, no offense to my children, but being a grandmother is the best. It is the best thing yet. And there's also a reason, though, why mothers and fathers tend to be younger people. Grandmothers and grandfathers tend to be older people, because it is exhausting as a grandmother chasing after a toddler. Liana is now 2 years old. And in this terrible year of COVID, where many people have died, become ill, people have lost their jobs, there's been a lot of hardship this year. I will say a blessing for me this year was that both of my children, including baby Liana, came home for about 2 months, because the COVID was rampaging through New York, if you remember, in the early days. And so they left New York and they came down to me. So I once again had a full, complete full household. I had people, and it seems like in every room, everybody needed their own workspace. And I was the primary childcare for Liana, who was, you know, much younger then. She was only like a year old at that point. And this is where I realized, holy cow, this is really, really exhausting. But I will forever cherish those 2 months, having all that unexpected family time. With all that said, my advice to parents is basically threefold. The first thing is, just like you would on the job, at home, you need to make priorities. Not everything is equally important as everything else. And I dare say at the top of the priority list ought to be time with your children, time with your spouse. So I would advise, let go of other things. Invest less time in keeping the house tidy, less time in meal preparation. Obviously, everybody's got to eat, but you don't have to become a gourmet cook, so that you can maximize your time on the most important priorities, which for most people is time with their children and spouse. The second piece of advice is, just like you would on the job, assemble a great team. Don't try to do everything yourself at home. So the team will probably include your spouse if you have one. It could include parents. It could include neighbors, if you can afford it, some sort of childcare. Assemble a team. The people who burn out are the people who try to do too much all by themselves. And even if you have a spouse and you are sharing it, I would still say look beyond and try to get more of a team. You'll have more peace of mind if you do. And then the third thing is what I call let go of perfection. Perfection, the idea of perfection, I think, is especially devastating to women, because we just want to be perfect at everything. We want to be perfect mothers, perfect professionals, perfect cooks, perfect this, that, and the other. And the fact of the matter is, perfection really doesn't exist. And just because you see all these beautiful pictures on, you know, Instagram or Facebook, and it looks like other people are leading perfect lives, they're not. It's a lie, right? So perfection is a lie. So understand that. Let go of it and understand that balance is balance. And there's going to be times when you have to lean into the job and that team at home is going to back you up, but then you'll lean back and you'll be able to then lean forward into home life. And hopefully you've got that team on the job that is going to back you up. So let go of this idea of perfection. Balance is the right balance for you.
Yes, ma'am. That's excellent advice. And again, I'm someone that also loves lists and just kind of a step-by-step process. So the way that you framed it is definitely easy to digest. And I think easy to apply, of course, always easier said than done. But that's certainly very helpful. And I'm glad that the downtime of the pandemic allowed you to really consolidate your family at your house. And I'm sure be there for a lot of great milestones with your granddaughter, you know, moving between the 12-month to 24-month time window. There's a lot of fun things that children usually accomplish during that time.
Absolutely.
Well, ma'am, we're so grateful that you were able to join us today. And we always like to give our guests the last word for any final words of wisdom or encouragement that you might have for our audience today.
Well, there's just maybe two other strategies from Aim High that I wanted to put out there that we haven't touched upon yet, because I think they're important ones. The first is what I call, you know, have a plan A, but be prepared to pivot. And what I mean by this is I think everybody, no matter where you are in life, you ought to have some reasonable idea of what you want to do in the next few years. So that's what I call the plan A. It'll change over time, and it's not in stone, after all, even today. But what are the key things you think you ought to be doing in order to reach that goal, and you need to be working on it? That's your plan A. But at the same time, remember, sometimes life will intervene in a positive way, other times in a negative way. You could have a setback. You could have a new opportunity that comes your way. Be prepared to pivot. Agility is very, very important these days. The other principle I wanted to just get out there is, and we did say this very briefly, and that's the importance of leading a life of continual learning. So if you're like me and fresh out of school and you're like, ugh, I can't bear to have to read another book. I'm so glad, you know, I don't have to do this anymore. Give yourself a break. That's okay for a while. Pat yourself on the back for this great accomplishment of getting through school, but don't like rest on your laurels for too long. You got to get back in the game of always leading a life of continual learning. And reading is a fantastic way to do that. You know, you might go to get a new technical certification. You might go back to school and get another degree. You might just read some books about some areas that you are not up to speed on. There's all kinds of ways to constantly be leading that life of continual learning. If you allow yourself to stagnate, your career will stagnate too. So don't let that happen to you.
Ma'am, those are great words of advice as graduation season approaches us, that even once we're out of school, we can't stop to be continuous learners. So thank you again for joining us. And for all of our listeners, we will see you again next week on DoD Reads.
Thanks for listening to this episode of What Are You Reading? A podcast produced through partnership with DoD Reads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share it. Leave us a comment with your answer to the question, what are you reading? Also, visit dodreads.com for free books, book reviews, interviews with your favorite authors, and many more free professional development resources. See you next week.